One of the great problems in society today is, I believe, is that we have been disentangling the soul. It's almost like you come into work and everybody says, oh, you look okay. That takes care of the body. You do your job. There's the mind. And if you mention soul, you're out of luck.
This is Culture at a Crossroads with David Mann.
Joining me in conversation, the former first vice president of CIBC Wood Gundy and the founder of Respectonomics, Jeremy Wentworth Stanley. How are you doing?
I am well, and good morning to you.
It's good to be in conversation. You've got an infectious sense of humor. Where does that come from?
I think it comes from my mother. She was Welsh, and she always saw the funny side of life. You might even think she was a sort of John Cleese fan. But no, she was an interesting lady. She wasn't what I would call well-educated. Both of my parents were, they were born in unusual places. My father was born in India. He was actually born in Karachi, which is now part of Pakistan. And the connection there was that his father, my grandfather, ran the health system in India. Huh. And my mother was born in Hong Kong.
Wow.
And the reason for that is that her father, again, my maternal grandfather, he was in charge of Shell Petroleum in Asia, which in those days was a kind of a distant outpost. But he was interesting. He was a couple of things about him. One is that he was the organist at the Hong Kong Cathedral. And also he was his middle name. No, his first name was Temple. And the reason for that is that his godfather was Archbishop Temple, who was the one, you know, we see a lot of his work and this kind of thing.
Wow.
I mean, I'm going back quite a few years, mind you.
Well, you've got some really celebratory roots in your family, some connections to Massey too.
Well, the Massey connection was actually grandfather's brother, my Uncle Guy. And Uncle Guy was an interesting character. He was an engineer, and he was the one who put Massey Harris and Ferguson together. And he's also another interesting point to tell you. He was lived in Southampton, Ontario, and he was a very sick man. And the doctor said to him, at the very end, said to him, I'm sorry, Mr. Bevan, but the outcome doesn't look good. And Uncle Guy said, I'm an engineer, and I know when the engine isn't ticking over properly. And I mentioned that. I've used this statement several times because in a way it's very reflective of the world today. The engine isn't ticking over properly.
Wow. It's insightful.
Yeah, I think it was a very helpful comment.
So your parents come from these very eclectic backgrounds, and then you come along and you've got quite a you know, a heritage before you, and you get to go to school at a pretty renowned place.
My background is I was educated at Eton. And then when I graduated from Eton, we didn't call it graduation, but I took my A-levels and that. And the plan was that I would go to Cambridge. Can you imagine walking through this little village where we lived in England? And this fellow comes up to me. His name was Michael Pelham. And he comes up to me and asks me what I'm doing. And then he says, well, we have boats or ships that go over to Canada. Do you want a ride? You tell that to a 17-year-old. And I took the ride. I never made it back.
Wow. And you had just gone through one of the most prestigious schools in all of the UK. And and you had this possible path before you, but you chose to go with the unknown.
Yeah. And I mean, I think when you think of a sort of prestigious background, I mean, I am very, very fortunate, both in terms of education, background, and so on. And I, you know, I often do look back. And particularly, and I look back in today's world where education's become so, what's the word, shapeless. And, you know, we don't really know how people are being educated. I was given an incredibly rigid academic background. And I think I probably at the time wondered, what's this all about? But the truth of the matter is, 70-odd years later, I'm 73, I look back and I'm so grateful that I've got this education. My training was basically in the classics, in Latin and Greek, and I can still recite the Greek alphabet.
Wow, that's impressive.
I can translate a little bit of Latin, My favorite line is Lex de minimis non curat. The Lord doesn't give a fig about little details.
So in these years, when did your faith become a pillar to you?
My academic background, if you'd call it that, very, very strongly entrenched. Example, at prep school, we had prayers in the morning, prayers in the evening. When I got to Eton, it was three Sunday services. There was an early morning communion, there was a morning service, and there was an evening service, and they were all compulsory.
Anglican?
Yep. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Died in the wool Anglican. We'll leave that one alone.
And that was pretty formative for you.
Well, it was. And I think, again, so like so many of these things, at the time, it was probably a bit of a trudge. One thing I was very clear on looking back on it all is it was far more of a religion than a relationship. Mm. And I'm not complaining about that, because in actual fact, it gave me the grounding. It gave me, you know, so much classically of the understanding of the Old and the New Testament, the formation of prayer, all these kinds of things. So that's not a complaint. And of course, built with that was, you know, the philosophy of Plato and Socrates and translations of Latin from Juvenal and Lucretius and this kind of thing. So having all that in the mix is, I find, very useful today. Mm. My faith, and I came to Canada, used to go to church quite regularly, and one of the reasons I used to go to church, and I think this is an important dynamic, one of the reasons was I was fundamentally lonely. Mm. And I think we're going to be talking about loneliness later. But it's a strange thing that you can be surrounded by people, you can be at your place of work and all those good things, but you can still be very lonely. Mm. And just not have that sense of someone that you can just share with and enjoy and laugh with and so on. My faith really, if I can sort of fast forward you now, really came about because in the Anglican setting, they had a conference of the Holy Spirit. Mm. This was down in London, Ontario. And I went to it with sort of my arms crossed, wondering, what's this all about? And I had one of those encounters, and there's some things that hadn't been quite right in my life. Mm. And I remember saying to there was a little table set aside where you could go and have private prayer. And I went across to have private prayer. I've never forgotten what the minister said. Hmm. I said to him what had happened. And his opening line was, well, you're forgiven. And I think it was the first time in my life I had ever experienced forgiveness.
Wow.
Not a finger pointing, not the you shouldn't have done that, not a what were you thinking. There was none of that sort of awful schoolboy, schoolmaster relationship. It was strictly, it was an opening. It was wonderful. And from there, I started talking more about my freedom and my expression of my relationship with God. But it wasn't until, believe it or not, I was one evening, I think it was a Monday evening, was at a full gospel businessman's fellowship. Mm. I remember to this day, the fellow who was talking, I haven't a clue what he was talking about. I really can't. He was a barrister or a solicitor from the Caribbean, and with a record that was unimaginable. It was incredible. Hmm. Anyway, he started talking about stuff and so on. And I just had a call at the end of it all to surrender to Christ. Hmm. That's all it was. And I remember going forward and saying to someone, I want to surrender, hand the keys to Christ. And he said, oh, well, that's easy enough. All you have to do is say so. Mm. Do you know it took me, I'm going to say 10, 20 minutes for the words to come out? Mm. It was the biggest fight I ever had in my life with me. Mm. I mean, I was quite used to fighting other people, but fighting with me, it was extraordinary. But the words eventually came out. And I would say this to anybody. When those words come out and you surrender to Christ, it's just like the whole world's burdens are taken off your shoulder. Mm. You're free.
And you experienced that?
That's what I experienced. Amazing. And I treasure it to this day. I really should have kept a better diary or a journal, but this was well over 30 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where are you at this point in your career?
Well, as you might have gathered already, I retired. And the reason I retired, it's partly because of your industry that I retired, because I was on the radio with Dave Carr over in Owen Sound, and very, very secular. It was all talking about what was going on in the economy and this, that, and the other. And there we were chatting away. What I didn't realize was that my wife was listening to the show on the, this was, I was taking the call in my office in the barn. I think you've been there. And I was taking the call there. Didn't realize she was listening because you can't have the radio on in the barn. Otherwise you get the, what, the back feed? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, background noise.
Background. So couldn't do that. She was listening on her iPhone. I come out of my office and the look she gives me is, frankly, the look that only a mother or a wife or a lady can give you. Mm. It was a look that you knew you had messed up. And I couldn't think how I'd messed up. I just couldn't think of it. And I thought, had I said everybody's ugly or something ridiculous? But in fact, what she said was, and she, I came out and she said to me, why don't you start mucking around and write a book? Mm. And that's where the second part of my life has gone. Mm. That afternoon, I retired from 51 years with CIBC Wood Gundy. And I started writing the book. And this is a very important, what I would call turning or a junction that I think I need to be very mindful of, because started writing the book. And it was really quite funny. I mean, talking about how I got born and all sorts of funny things and that. But it was serious as well. It was talking about all the conjunctions of life. Talking about earnings per share, manners, balance of payments, kindness, all kinds of subjects. But what I found was after 2 or 3 months, the book was writing me. And that's when, as the book was starting to write me, I started what I call laying down my arms and wondering, what is this all about? And I want to pass one comment back. And I think what happened was that I had gone fallow. Fallow is a very important word. It's actually, I think it's in the book of Leviticus that we, the ancient Israelites, were required to have one of their fields, their agricultural fields, had to be made fallow once every 7 years. Does that sound familiar?
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
And why that's of interest is that when land goes fallow, what actually happens is the land is not expected to produce anything. The farmer doesn't come back at a year later and say, now, what have you done? It is, it's just left to be itself. It's almost a wilderness experience, but it's left to be itself. And what happens is the land is then allowed to rejuvenate. It's allowed to restore its humus. It's allowed to allow the parasites and the bugs and the insects, the worms and all that kind of stuff to work through. Very importantly, because not only does that re-nutrify the ground, but it also improves the drainage. If you think of our human lives, what we need is drainage. We need to be able to let the toxins out. So being fallow is a very valuable expression of one's life. And of course, to get the what you call the toxins and the garbage out of our lives, we are so fortunate that we can come to the cross. With that in mind, there's another thing that's very important with the fallow. The Victorians found this out. They found out that if a land goes fallow, they developed what they called the fallow protocol, which meant that when the land was then brought back into circulation, it wasn't always good for the same crops that they had used beforehand. And the message there is, we go out in fallow, we go out in sabbatical, we go out into the wilderness. Doesn't mean automatically that we should come back to the jobs we were doing before.
Might be a rotation.
Absolutely. That's the whole concept of being fallow.
Wow.
But if you look at soil today, what do you hear? You hear it's being overly used. You hear about excessive compression of the soil. You hear excessive use of chemicals. It's a very useful metaphor or allegory to how we can lead our lives. And Christ himself, was he not in the wilderness? And the other thing is, last thing about this fallow experience is, no one said to me, well, what are you doing? What are you expecting out of it? It's an important point. Fallow doesn't have a sense of expectation. You know, when you go on vacation or you go on a break and somebody says, what are you going to do? That question was never asked. It's a very valuable point. So you don't feel constrained. You're allowed to be, frankly, open to the fullness of God's grace.
Amazing. Well, before we delve more into this second chapter of your life where you are right now, could you just give our listeners a little bit more insight into that first chapter in terms of your career? You were the first vice president of CIBC Wood Gundy. In a nutshell, what did that look like?
Very corporate at one level. I was very fortunate because I enjoyed the corporate structure in the sense that I knew a lot of people up and down the system and across the system. I had friends across the country and so on. And I had connections internationally. So from one point of view, I was very tuned in. In my persona, I am always interested, have always been interested in, broadly speaking, what would you call it, socioeconomics, the politics of the world, and so on. And I like sharing and talking about these things. My experience was, there were two big parts to my life. One was what's called investment banking. Investment banking is the part where you're bringing companies to the market and giving them the opportunity to raise capital in the public markets. Or not just raise money, it could be mergers, acquisitions, and that sort of thing. So for a time, I was the syndication manager in, believe it or not, in London, England. They actually sent me back. Can you imagine? I know.
Full circle.
A lot of jokes to go with that. But anyway, and then really the real thrust of my career was in wealth management, which was much more of a personal, individual relationship where we were talking to people about their state of finances, the development of their wealth, development of their future prosperity, and so on. The byline was to help people meet and exceed their financial goals, which, if I take out the word financial, we could probably replace that with lots of other words. But the point of the matter is that was the general principle. I ended up being in the Owen Sound office, actually, and I was there for many, many years. I think it was about 40 years, roughly. And that's where I developed a lot of relationships. And I would say that there were two things I've noticed about my career. One is on a macro basis, when people talk to me about what was going on in the world, what was going on with oil prices, what was going on with consumer spending and capital spending and so on, the big picture I usually got right. And that was my forte. What I found more difficult was when I look back in my career was on a micro business basis, I was less successful. I think that I would have done better to have focused on the macro and then let others individually, if you will, or businesses take over the actual management of the money. There really are two different threads. One is, as I say, macro, one is micro. The macro, as I say, that came to me very naturally. And if you think of my background was macro. You know, whether you talk about where I was born, family backgrounds, all that kind of stuff. So it made sense. But the relationship with individuals, I formed some wonderful relationships. I frankly can never quite get over them. And it was interesting. I hesitate to say my desk was my pulpit, but I was always aware of the fact that there were openings when I could bring Christ to the table. And as you know, in the world of secularism and bureaucracy and all that, you can't just go out and talk freely about what you believe and your faith and so on. And I must confess, one of the things I'm enjoying about retirement and being on my own, as it were, is the ability to go forward and to state my claim. And on the business of stating my claim, one of the things I've been working on is we look at the individual and we say, you know, what is the business of the individual? What are you and I, you know, what is our primary business? I can give you the what I call the Christian answer. I can take us back to Genesis and come out with the answer. But one of the things I'm developing and I think is important is to honor other people's freedom of choice. That doesn't mean to say you agree with it. But I think it's important that we allow each other this freedom of choice. One of the things I find in the secular world today is in a regulatory context is how often we are prohibited or restricted from being able to speak. And I'm not saying people should agree with me, But I think people should allow us that freedom of expression. Mm. I can't remember if it was Voltaire or somebody, but one of those great philosophers who said, I don't agree with what you said, but I shall defend to the end your right to say it.
Mm.
And I think that's part's missing. This business of inclusiveness and acceptance and tolerance and all that has strangely got a sort of strange sort of scorpion-like twist in it.
Mm-hmm.
And we find that we don't have the freedom to talk, which is really very, very strange.
Mm-hmm. It's ironic.
It is. It's a contradiction, actually.
Yeah. Well, back to this chapter that you're in currently, mm-hmm. you mentioned that this book has been writing you.
Mm-hmm.
So what in particular has it been writing?
What I found was I'm going to take you back one line. The business background that I came from was Peter Drucker was one of my heroes. And Peter Drucker, he's no longer with us. He was the chair of the Salvation Army, and he was a management consultant. And interestingly, the Salvation Army was regarded as one of the best-run corporations in the world.
Wow.
Which is just an interesting byline. And, you know, when you think about it, all you ever hear about the Salvation Army is good stuff.
It's true. It's positive.
It's just one of those quirky things, you know, whether they're ringing the bells at Christmas or whether they're looking after the dispossessed, you know, on a Sunday afternoon. It's all you hear about. But Peter Drucker's great principle was that every organization should gather itself once a year, everybody. So whether you're polishing door handles or whether you're the chief financial officer arranging syndicated credits in Europe, you bring everybody together and you ask one question: what is our business? Not a bad thing to do. So you get everybody on the same page. So instead of somebody saying, well, I'm welding these nuts and bolts, the person would actually say, I'm building a railroad. So you get everybody on the same drive, the same mm-hmm. spirit. I took that line back one more, like an onion skin. I went back a little further and ended up with, what is my business? And I just said a moment ago, my business is to honor other people's freedom of choice. But in coming back to what is my business, if we agree that you need everybody to come together corporately, the way we just said it, then you'd also say, then if you say to me, what is my business, I have to bring the entirety of my being to the table as well. And my entirety is the tripartite Jeremy.
Mm.
The tripartite David, the tripartite human being. The tripartite is body, mind, and soul that all have to come to the table at the same time. And if we're going to ask, what is my business, I need to be honest that whatever I'm looking at is appropriate for the body, appropriate for the mind, and appropriate for the soul. And one of the great problems in society today is, I believe, is that we have been disentangling the soul.
Hmm.
It's almost like you come into work and everybody says, oh, you look okay. That takes care of the body. You do your job. There's the mind. And if you mention soul, you're out of luck. And that's a terrible thing to do. It's very cruel because in actual fact, every human being is this tripartite being. I mean, love it or leave it. That's one thing. But secondly, the way I look at it is this. If you go and buy a bicycle, for example. And I want you to think of a bicycle like one of these really, really expensive bicycles that's made of, what are these fancy metals they talk about? Vanadium and palladium and I don't know, all these eums.
Makes it super light.
Oh yeah, it's brilliant. You know, and it's got servo-assisted hydraulic brakes and GPS stuff that also measures your heart rate. I mean, it's incredible.
Yeah.
But I want you to imagine you get this bicycle.
Okay.
And you've just spent $10,000 on this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as you're leaving the store, the salesperson says to you, oh, by the way, you only get 2/3 of the chain.
Mm.
You would say, that's not going to work very well.
No, I'm not going to be able to use the bike.
No, you're not going to be able to use the bike. And I think that applies to the human being.
Hmm.
The human being is three parts, the body, the mind, and the spirit or the soul. And all three need to be integrated and allowed to come together, to be respected. And if I was going to push the button just a little harder, I would say also to be loved and respected. And therein lies the heart of respectonomics, that we need these three components to be able to come to the table, whether it's in a family setting, whether it's a community, whether it's a business, whether it's corporate, it doesn't really matter. All three need to be able to come to the table together and enjoy what you might call enjoy each other. I mean, juvenile. Mm. Everybody knows they're juvenile, don't they? Everybody's translated him from Latin. Come on. But Juvenal said, mens sana, corpore sano, a healthy mind and a healthy body. It's pretty straightforward. And I think this needs additional emphasis in today's world. And I believe the Lord has been laying this on my heart. I'll tell you why.
Yeah,
because what I'm talking about is not a message for a corporation. I'm talking about a message that works in every possible direction. Mm-hmm. Whether we're talking church, whether we're talking community, bureaucracy, whatever you want, it doesn't matter. Whatever direction you're going in, this concept of allowing this tripartite being to be given full expression must be right. I mean, this is what God created us with. Mm-hmm. He created us in his image. We are, and maybe this is where I'm really, really starting to thump the pavement. What I'm really coming to is we were made in the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
And in the image of God, we as human beings are nothing other than utterly, utterly remarkable. I quiz people and say, have you ever sat at the table and had a cup of coffee and you get this sort of blank look of yes? And then you say, and have you ever tickled your toe at the same time? Yes. And have you picked up the newspaper with the other hand? Yes. And have you turned to a different channel on the TV? Yes. And have you actually got up to let the dog in or out? Yes. Have you greeted your spouse and as she comes in through the kitchen door? Yes. My question, can you show me any other sentient being that can do that? I can't think of any sentient being, animal, plant, whatever you want to say, that can do that. And I'm also going to take you one more step. We've heard a lot about artificial intelligence, which I think is a very crude attack on God. The intelligence we have is from him. And I can almost prove it to you.
Hmm.
The word brain is spelt B-R-A-I-N. My brain is bigger than artificial intelligence. It is smaller than I am, and I'm surrounding it.
Hmm.
And I'm going to keep it under siege.
Hmm. Wow.
So I think the Lord has basically laid this on me, because for a message to be omnidirectional, a message that talks about the supreme utility of the human being, I think this is a message that, because it, as I say, crisscrosses every dimension, both backwards and forwards, that to me is godly.
Mm.
I mean, do we not say, I mean, right through, what is it, when it says that God is with us at all times, and God never changes.
Mm-hmm.
He's under us, he's over us. And then we look up and realize that it's Jesus Christ who's our Lord and our Savior. And he is the one who is looking after and so able to work with us. Have you noticed in today's world, a world of loneliness, where we were just talking about that with some of your colleagues, and a world today is so lonely. And one of the reasons it's so lonely is because you go onto the internet to get an answer. Mm-hmm. The classic was, when was Standard Oil broken up? And somebody yells, look it up on the internet. Actually, what you wanted to talk about was the whole concept of the oil industry, the way it came into being, the Rockefeller wealth, and all of that kind of stuff. But you get these instant answers that basically close down discussion.
Reductionism.
Yeah, it's awful. So you get an answer. The date was, 1907. Great. And that's the end of that subject. It doesn't explore. It doesn't allow. One of the things I love about the Bible is it's forever testing us. It's forever putting in front of us things we don't understand. I just read yesterday out of Matthew 22 where the Sadducees gang up on Christ and basically say to him, who's your neighbor? What is it? What's the greatest commandment?
Mm.
And he says to love the Lord your God with all your might and all your strength. And then he goes on further and talks about this. It's almost like a riddle. Where he talks about, was David the son of God or was David the father of God, the father of Jesus Christ? And you get yourself into one of these, I don't know what you call
predicaments.
It. Predicaments. That's fine. That's the most wonderful thing, that we can be allowed mm-hmm. to come into mm-hmm. these predicaments. God wants us in those predicaments. He wants us to be able to ask questions. He wants us to muddle our way through them. He wants us to pray over them. It's really exciting, actually, because you come up with different answers you couldn't possibly come out on your own.
Yeah.
And I put Respectonomics right in the crosshairs of that, that without God, there is not a hope I would have had any of these kinds of insights or answers.
Mm. So this is your baby, Respectonomics. What does it look like practically? Are you envisioning to equip workplaces, equip businesses with this sort of perspective?
Well, the answer there is very interesting, because what I found is, and I think I may have mentioned to you in our previous chats, one of the things I've noticed, if I go up to the proverbial CEO, I shouldn't say proverbial, I'm talking about the actual CEO of that ilk. And I say to that individual, the human being is made up of body, mind, and spirit. And you can probably guess what the answer is. It's usually a sort of a frown, a slightly glazed look, and as one, you can almost see the think sign coming out of the mouth, which says, excuse me, we're in the business of making money. That's the instant. 3 seconds later, that same individual says to me, yes, Jeremy, you're right. People know this.
Mm-hmm.
It's not exactly the world's greatest trade secret that we are tripartite beings. And what the CEO needs, and this is my job, I think, and not just the CEO, but people need, is to understand that the three of us need to be at the table at all times.
Mm.
And that the corporation, I don't expect the corporation to be my church. I don't expect the corporation to be my nursing home. I don't expect the corporation to be my nanny. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking them to engage with each part of my being so that that part of my being can be expressed in a friendly and natural way. That sounds a bit heavy, but what I mean is this, that a business should be able to look at me and to respect my body. They pay me wages. It's not a bad way of respecting me. They respect my mind because they put me on courses, but they need to respect my soul and to give me the quiet space I need, or the time away, or whatever it is that a soul needs to like we were talking about fallow, to resuscitate itself. But there's two sort of flips to this. I've just said, and we've just said, this is what the corporation does for me. That's only half the story. The other half of the story is, what do I do for the corporation?
Work becomes more efficient.
Mm-hmm. Well, we can come onto that in a minute, because out of this combination of what the business does for me and what I do for the business, you know, I've been watching these strikes going on and these labor relation issues with GM and Ford and Stellantis and so on. And I don't know if you've noticed, but the whole thing is, what are you going to do for me? Where are my wages? Where are my benefits? Where is this? And I mean, understandably, people are, you know, they're very frightened. They're looking for protection. They're looking for some kind of assurance. I get that. But not once did I see, what are those individuals going to do for the corporation?
Mm.
And I think this is part of that reciprocity. If I'm going to look at God and say, God, and I do this every morning, you know, would you please make sure I have a wonderful day and wonderful relationships and everything? Is it not axiomatic that I should be doing the same thing for God and asking him, what can I do for you, God?
Mm.
He's a God of communication. He's a God who wants us to be in communication with him. That's an absolute. So if I'm going to be in touch with other people, I need to be in touch with God, and I need to be surrendered to what is it that God wants me to do for him. Now, out of this, you just mentioned this issue of efficiency. There's another part to this puzzle. A lot of people might listen to this and say, it all sounds jolly moral. Well, it's not jolly moral. It's actually bringing the whole foundation of Jesus Christ to the table at what you might call at every juncture. That's part one. But part two, what do we get out of this? What is the benefit of this? Is there a one? Is there a reward? And I think there are two rewards we should talk about. The first one is that when you have this symbiosis, when you have the business and the individual coming together in this sense of harmony, you create unity. And unity is one of the greatest callings in the Bible. The word is constantly asking us to be united. If you noticed in churches, A church that is disunited is a church that fails. Mm-hmm. We are called to be united together. We're called to respect each other's body, minds, and spirits. That's part one. So the first thing is it encourages unity. With unity comes two things. One is, in a very practical sense, it helps to reduce employee rollover. Secondly, it helps to increase productivity. And thirdly, as I've just said, it brings us to the point of unity.
Wonderful. We're going to have to just pause for a second. He's going to do his news and then please can wrap it up. Okay, go ahead.
And on the subject of unity, there's something that is crucially important. Paul refers constantly to the church as a human body, does he not?
Mm-hmm. He sure does.
He talks about us being the arms and the feet and so on. And the concept of unity dovetails very well with this. First of all, when you're in a state of unity, I'll give you a good example. If you've ever picked up a hammer and decided to hit a nail, have you ever found that you actually hit your thumbnail instead? Have you ever done that?
I have. I'll admit it.
Well, I'm going to make one guarantee.
What's that?
That you don't pick up the same hammer and actually hit the other thumb.
Why is that?
Because it would hurt. In other words, one of the great tragedies of disunity is we're very good at picking up the hammer and hitting the other thumbnail. It's not attractive. So we want to work against disunity and bring ourselves into a place of unity. It's biblical. It's supported very nicely by Paul. And another thing about it is this. He says on the human body, he talks about the arms and the legs and the eyes and so on. But one of the things he emphasizes, and we need to do this in our corporate world, our social world, our community world, is that no part of the body is superior to the other. Mm. In other words, if your left hand is hurting, it is your right hand that comes to massage it. If your foot is hurting, same principle applies, you massage it. No part of the body is hierarchically above or below another. What we do say is that parts of the body are functionally different. Presumably, your shoulder is doing a different job from your knee. And that's fine. So we all have our different functions, different responsibilities. The head of the body is Jesus Christ. Mm. That is where we get our directions from, and that is where the whole body reports back to. Mm. So we have this concept of unity to begin with. But I want to show you something else.
Yes, please do.
We as human beings love unity. I came into your radio station this morning, and if anybody had said to me, what does it feel like? I would have said, it feels like a united body. Mm. It feels like everybody is united in purpose and design. That's what it feels like. And in and of itself, it's very attractive. If you go into somebody's house where there's a family, have you had that experience? You go in, and there's mum and dad and the children, and they're all running around, and then the grandparents show up, and everybody's laughing, and there's sandwiches flying around.
You can feel it.
You can feel it. What is your feeling? Your feeling is you're drawn into it. You love it. We as human beings do not like disunity. Mm. So the first thing is that unity in itself is very attractive. And if you're going to put this into a corporate context, unity becomes a very valuable asset. It happened to me once. My daughter, who likes to think that she knows how to dress me, and she's the one who shows me where I'm going to buy my suits and this kind of thing. She took me into Brooks Brothers in Toronto. Very splashy store. Introduces me to the fellow who's in charge of suits. Do you know what the first thing he did was?
What?
He didn't say to me, oh, well, sir, you need a pinstripe or a herringbone or whatever. He said, I'd like you to meet the other people on our staff.
Mm.
And took me to meet the receptionist, meets the lady, I think, who was doing the alterations, some of the other people who were involved in designing and so on. But you felt that you had just walked into what you might call an integrated circuit.
Mm.
It was a really, really lovely feeling. And a company today that demonstrates unity will experience that same almost affection. People will come to you for that. Mm. It's a wonderful expression.
Mm.
But secondly, though, with unity of this sort, we also get, I mentioned already, we get the issue of productivity, we get the issues of innovation, and we start stemming this tide of employee turnover or rollover. That's, I mean, I don't know if you know this, but employee turnover is extremely expensive. It's very disruptive.
Yeah, very much
and
so.
It's actually very unattractive. So the concept of the unity that brings people together in a sense of loyalty and continuity, that's pretty attractive. I think there's one other aspect here. The broad brush comment today is, we talk about what's going on in the world. If you look at the world today and you talk about the world's problems, every single problem I look at, without naming names or people or anything, the absolute denominator is disunity. Whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Hamas, take your pick. All of these have disunity at their heartbeat. We need unity back to bring people back together. In other words, respecting the body and the mind and the soul. Mm. Where mental health is concerned, and it's become one of these almost brushwords, you know, you hear politicians sort of holding their lapels and saying, yes, we're terribly concerned about mental health. And you hear it in different avenues. It is an incredibly serious problem. But there are two kinds of mental health that we need to address.
Okay.
There's the primary mental health issue. The primary one are those horrific challenges that people have that in the old days we'd refer to them as disabilities. We talk about challenges and we talk about all those words, but they are genetic. They're born. I don't know enough about the different channels of where people have those difficulties, but I'm fully aware that when somebody is, shall we say, autistic, to use one word, they are presented with biological genetic challenges that go beyond just being able to counsel and say, you'll be all right, way beyond that. Hmm. That's what I call a primary health issue. The secondary health issue, though, is ones where we have allowed ourselves to become whatever we have become. We have become this because of our circumstances and our upbringings, some of our emotional issues. I mean, perhaps you'll remember those days at school when everybody laughed at you. Do you remember that? And so what you do now is make sure you'll do anything to prevent yourself being laughed at. These are what I call secondary emotional issues. And I think we societally can do a lot for those kinds of issues by drawing alongside people and showing them that unity of spirit, the unity of body, and the unity of mind. Mm. It's where people feel safe, where people feel, oh, you're the same as I am.
They can let their guard down.
Mm. Because once your guard is down, we can deal with it.
That's right.
And loneliness is one of the nastiest antidotes to that, because what it does is it doesn't let you let your guard down.
It puts it up.
And you become more entrenched. It's like one of those nasty vortices, is that the right word? Becomes a nasty thing where you find yourself spiraling down even further. So this is why it's so important for us to be that all-around embracing. This isn't idealistic. This is incredibly pragmatic. It's very functional. It's very useful. And if you want to use a capitalistic expression, it's very profitable. But how much better to be profitable in the financial sense when you can actually say you're being profitable for God?
Mm.
That's a wonderful combination, and I think we can do it. But we have to come back to the essential primacy of the human being. There's not one transaction that takes place in this world. You go to Tim Hortons, you go to the car wash, you go and sign up for something. Whatever it is you do, you go on these fantastic holidays to Barbados. Whatever you do, at the heart of it is a human being.
Mm.
You cannot get away from that. And if that is the case, then we need to go back to the drawing board and let God be God and let the human being understand the imagery in which he and she were created.
Beautiful. Well, if this message is resonating with you, if you know someone who has a business, if you know a corporation that could use some fine tuning in this way, we want to point you to the resource that you can get your hands on right now over at respectonomics.com. And Jeremy, is there other places where people could go to get more help in this area?
Well, I also have jeremywentworthstanley.com. I've got that. I have Office in the Barn, which is exactly what it sounds like. My office is in the barn. And I think you know how to get hold of me. So by all means, name should be out there. And we need to come together in a sort of conjugal sense to bring the world to a safer and a happier place that is blessed by none other than Jesus Christ.
Amen. And this is timely. Mm. We've suffocated the soul for too long. It's time to let it live and thrive.
Let it breathe.
Yeah, let it breathe. Well, Jeremy, you're a very formidable speaker. I really appreciate the way that you've been able to weave this together.
Do you want me to talk about my speaking skill?
Do it.
Well, it's a funny thing for your listeners and for you. I don't think you know this. I, as you know, was educated at Eton.
Yep.
Guess the two subjects I failed at Eton. And failure, by the way, at Eton meant it was that big F. It didn't say you could go on. It didn't have any sort of, oh, you're okay. It was, let's take you down to the trenches.
Do you fail English?
I failed English and public speaking.
Wow.
Thank you, God.
It was a gift in the end.
Yeah, of course.
Because you had to work that much harder at it. Mm-hmm.
Here I am.
Here you are. Okay, Jeremy Wentworth Stanley, from his childhood to CIBC Wood Gundy to his newest chapter that is trailblazing throughout the world, Respectonomics. Thank you for taking this time.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for listening today. A reminder that you can access any of our episodes when you head to the Culture at a Crossroads podcast. We do invite you back next week as we once again explore the intersection of faith and culture in Canada, helping to better equip you in following Jesus.